the Judiciary Committee meeting together, 25th March, and it's 1:34, and we have Senator Dyson, Senator McGuire, Senator Coghill, Chairman here, and there are several things we want to do on today's meeting. One of them is a confirmation hearing for H. Connor Thomas for the Legislative Ethics Committee. We want to get SB 72 up for its first introduction in committee and some questions. We're going to hold over HB 69. HB 69 was the exempt firearms from Fed regulation. I'll just give a short explanation on that. Because of the session going over last week, the time that I expected for public hearing on this has got kind of overrun, so I want to have some public hearing. There are some questions that I'm trying to get answered legally, so it's just kind of hit a snag, I'm sorry to say. SGR 9 today, my intention is to spend as much time as we can get out of this rest of the session and bring that up for a vote today. With that, we have, oh, and we just have Senator Olson join us. Welcome, Senator Olson. H. Connor Thomas, are you on the line and can you hear us? Mr. Thomas, can you hear us all right?
Well, I can now. They just unmuted it, so I didn't answer your question. I am on the line, and I can hear you, and I take it now you can hear me.
Okay, well, this is a confirmation hearing for you for being assigned to the Legislative Ethics Committee. First of all, thank you from me, and it's been a pleasure serving with you. So why don't you go ahead and put your name on the record and explain why you would like to continue doing this.
Okay, thank you. My name is Connor Thomas. I'm calling you from Nome, Alaska, where I reside, and I have for the last 35 years. I've served on the Ethics Committee since 1998. Most of that time, I've enjoyed the service on the committee. I believe in the purpose of the committee. I think the people of the state of Alaska do also. And one of the reasons that I am willing to continue to serve and would like to continue to serve is that I do think it's an opportunity for me to provide some public service, but it's not so onerous that I'm not able to continue on with my small law office practice here in Nome. So those are my reasons for wanting to continue to serve.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas, and it's been my pleasure, committee members, to say that I've served with him as one of the committee members, and I can only speak very highly of his thoughtful input and some of the things that we as a legislature put out under ethics laws, how to navigate them with circumstances that come before them. Are there any questions for Mr. Thomas? Seriously? No questions? All right. Mr. Thomas, it looks like people are satisfied because they not have question one. First of all, thank you for taking the time to call into the committee. I am going to make a motion to have you recommended to the full body for confirmation. And is there anything that you would like to ask us?
No, sir. I appreciate your kind words, and thank you for getting me on today.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator McGuire, why don't you go ahead?
Absolutely. And thank you. I thank you as well as Senator McGuire. Thank you, Mr. Thomas, for your years of service and your thoughtful deliberation that you bring to the Ethics Committee and all these years as we've moved through different trends and newsletters and things like that. You've just always had really good thoughts. So I appreciate it. So I move that we move the name of H. Connor Thomas onto the full body with individual recommendations to once again serve on the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics.
Any objections? So without any objection, then we'll forward your name on to the full body for for confirmation and any individual recommendations. Thank you, Connor, and I appreciate your work, and I'm going to miss working with you, but I expect great work from you. So have a pleasant day. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you.
That brings us to Senate Bill 72 for Senator Wilkowski. Thanks for joining us. Sir, for Senator Wilkowski and Senator French, Senator Olson, what I intend to do is bring up Senate Bill 72 to begin some of the introduction of it and maybe a few points to discuss. And then I'm going to not bring up House Bill 69 today, but we'll bring up SJR 9, the joint resolution on the constitutional amendment. So with that, I think we have with us Beth from, why don't you come on forward here? And if I got the name wrong, just correct me. Who is?
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
I'm Beth Leibowitz. I am Assistant Ombudsman with the Office of the Ombudsman for the State of Alaska. I believe Ombudsman Linda Lord-Jenkins is on the phone, available by teleconference, also to answer questions as needed by the committee.
Yes.
And I'd like to know, do you want me to discuss, simply give a summary of the bill, or would you like to go answer, have me answer questions at this point?
Thank you very much, and it is true, Linda Lord-Jenkins is online, so for any questions that come up, Tracy Wallenberg also is online from the Public Defenders Agency, and we have Steve Van Gore with the Alaska Bar Association, and I am anticipating a couple of questions there. So I think probably the thing we should do, Beth, is just go ahead and just give the overview of the bill, and then we can go into a couple questions, and then my expectation is to lay it aside. I think there will be a couple of amendments coming our way, and we'll maybe discuss the genesis of those before we set this aside. Please.
Thank you, sir. All right. What I'd like to do is give you the less exciting parts of the bill first, which are essentially housekeeping provisions for the Ombudsman's office.
All right.
It's been about 20-some years since our office had substantive revisions to our enabling legislation, and we've had some issues come up in the last couple of decades. And so I'd say we've got some issues regarding confidentiality provisions that we would like to have added to our statutes. And the first and foremost of those is that we would like our testimonial privilege amended to make it express that not only do we not testify in court, but that we do not produce documents, attend depositions, or go to administrative adjudications except as necessary to enforce the provisions of the Ombudsman's Act. In other words, we'd like the beefed up and modernized version of the privilege. We would also like to have confidentiality extended to communications that we have with the executive branch agencies that we investigate. And this is not requesting a privilege, but is asking that those communications be taken out of the public records realm so that they are not readily available. And that is because our current statute asks that we have that basically it requires that when we criticize the agency, we give them a confidential preliminary report. And that report cannot be released to the public by the agency. But there is nothing similar to cover all the emails and letters and assorted correspondence that probably led up to that confidential report.
And that would be Section 4 and 5 dealing with that particular issue?
That would be Section 4.
Okay.
Section 5 deals with attorney-client privilege. We do not have access to attorney-client privileged documents, but what we are asking is that if a state agency offers us the material to explain why they are doing what they are doing, we would like them to be protected and not have it be an inadvertent waiver of their privilege as to other parties.
Okay.
We'd like them to be able to be candid with us without being further at risk in litigation. Those are the confidentiality-related issues. We would like to have a express part of our statute that provides for informal investigative report. In other words, something that's in the area between a complaint that's closed as premature or simply declined and something that has a full formal investigative report signed by the Ombudsman. We would like a statutory mechanism that makes it clear what we're doing with the complaints that don't require that much in the way of resources, but do require some level of investigative work by our office. And those would be sections 6 through 9. And we are asking for an amendment to, we have a statute that provides for procurement. And as far as we can tell from doing the research, the language in that statute dates from several generations ago of the procurement code. And we would simply like it cleaned up, and we would like to make it bring us into alignment with legislative procurement policies.
All right.
We have two personnel-related housekeeping provisions. One of those is to unfreeze the ombudsman's salary, which is currently set by statute at Step A, Range 26, which is quite nice, but the ombudsman's office is the only legislative agency where the statute sets the salary not just in a given range or to be set by a committee, but actually freezes it at a step so that it cannot be increased at all under any circumstances. We would like the statute amended to allow it to be set at range 26 and to leave the step able to move. And we have one more section that asks to make it absolutely clear that we can hire a basically personal services contract employees as the rest of the legislative branch can. We have some statutory language that makes that less than absolutely clear. Legislative personnel has agreed that we can do this, but personally I would like to see it where there's absolutely no doubt about that matter. So that's our housekeeping provisions. May I take any questions from the committee about those?
From the housekeeping? All right. I think, for the most part, I think you've got, we have a pretty good idea. I think the compensation, range 26 step issue, probably we can make a recommendation, but it'll go to the Finance Committee for its final approval. On the contract procedures and a procurement code, my guess is you're just taking what we do as a legislature generally and applying them through these rules?
Yes. Yes, sir.
All right. All right. Go on to the less than housekeeping provisions.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yes, sir.
I do have a question.
Senator Olson.
You asked for the confidentiality to be changed to a certain degree. Has there been a problem with some of these issues that are being brought out that are part of the public record already?
Through the chair, we have had remarkably little trouble in this area. We have had one instance in the last year or so where we received a request for a letter that we had written to an agency where we had basically expressed that they might, we basically suggested gently that they might need to reconsider something.
Uh-huh.
And we were asked for a copy of that letter. Our records are very clearly confidential under our existing statute, so we declined to provide the requester with that correspondence. However, we realized that it was not really too clear what would happen if they went over to the state office building to the executive branch agency and asked for exactly the same document over there.
I see.
And in that case, I think it ultimately was a non-issue. But we considered that a yellow flag that we should be looking at this.
One further question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Has to do with freezing the salary, and was wondering, have you not been able to fill the position because of the salary issue?
Through the chair, I don't believe this has been a problem so far, and it has not been an issue that I'm aware of in my time at the Ombudsman's office, because I have served most of my time under Ombudsman Linda Lord Jenkins, who is in her third term at this point. However, there is a term limit, so a new ombudsman will need to be appointed in a few years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and can you tell us what the reasoning was for it being the only range that had been exempted from the step increases?
We're not exactly sure what the whole story is on that, but in 1975, when the Ombudsman Act was enacted, the ombudsman's salary was set as equal to that of a superior court judge, and which is not given to increase exactly, but was a fairly generous amount. Around 1987, during what appeared to be a general salary cutting and belt tightening period for legislative agencies. The legislature amended that to say Step A, Range 26. And when the Office of Victims' Rights was created in 2001, the victim's advocate received exactly the same compensation provision in that statute, 2465. However, last year, the legislature amended the victim's rights advocate statute to take the wording Step A out of that. So essentially, we're asking for parity.
Any other questions? All right. Next.
Well, we're also asking for two areas of jurisdictional determination from the legislature.
I'm sorry.
So the first of those is right there in Section 1 of the bill. Basically, we are asking the legislature to tell us whether or not we are supposed to investigate the Alaska Bar Association when there are complaints about that organization. That is a matter that has been unsettled in the history of our office since about 1980 when it first came up, and the ombudsman at that time said, well, it looks like an agency and unlike many ombudsman's offices, the Alaska ombudsman has jurisdiction over the administrative portions of the judicial branch. And so the ombudsman at the time said, well, it does look like an agency for our purposes. And of course, the Bar Association said, of course not. And the matter has remained unresolved for quite some time. I have done the analysis using the multi-factor test that the Supreme Court uses to determine whether something is a state agency in Alaska or not. And the factors split more or less down the middle. So if we went and were involved in litigation over this to, say, enforce a demand for documents during an investigation, it is not actually clear what a court would rule about the Bar Association's status relative to the Ombudsman Act. We do not really want to spend resources litigating this, so we're asking the legislature to make the call on whether or not this is something we're supposed to be even looking at.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And on that point, some folks have come to me with a concern about changing this to clarify that the bar is not deemed an agency. So I just have a couple questions for you. I understand, based on your testimony, what prompted the concern. And then I guess I would just ask, what would be the nature of an ombudsman complaint where you would seek access to records that the Bar Association might have, for example? Can you give the committee a feeling for that?
Through the chair, I went through our records to see what types of complaints we had received against the Bar Association in the last decade. And we've gotten about a dozen. It's not an awful lot. They trickle in. The majority of them have been complaints basically where the individual filed a grievance against their attorney, usually in a criminal defense matter, and was dissatisfied that the Bar Association did not proceed to do something dramatic to their former attorney. And in those cases, to do a full and satisfactory investigation, we would need to access the Bar Association's records of the grievance and how they handled it. And this does, I need to be very candid with you and say this does present a practical problem for us, because the Alaska court bar rules appear to restrict our access, and that does not appear to be something that can be amended like regular court procedural rules. There does appear to be an issue there, so we might not be able to complete a full and substantive investigation of that type of complaint.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. What other trade associations does the ombudsman declare to be an agency for purposes of investigatory authority do you have? And I guess an example that comes to mind would be the Alaska Medical Association, the Alaska Dental Association, the Alaska Nurses Association. Are those the kinds of organizations in Alaska that you have deemed to be agencies and have authority over as an ombudsman?
Through the chair, We do not have jurisdiction over those. We do have jurisdiction over state licensing agencies, which include the Alaska Medical Board, which determines whether or not someone is actually qualified and able to legally practice medicine in the state of Alaska, and the Nursing Board, and then a whole host of occupational licensing boards that are within the Department of Commerce. And those are all clearly within our jurisdiction, and that has not been a matter of dispute.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
So, for example, if an individual has trouble with a medical provider and they're not satisfied with a medical board's review, they come to the ombudsman, you're able to drill down into how they handle that complaint at the board level?
Yes, we are. We will not be, we will, in those cases, we're usually not able to give an answer to the complainant that will make them feel much better, because we cannot talk about the confidential material that we have accessed, but we can access it.
All right. And so when you report on findings, let's say you found something that a board did do improperly, what would be the answer? I'm thinking medical board, because of the confidentiality rules are so high there. What would the ombudsman be able to resolve? Would they make a recommendation to the legislature? How does that get recorded?
We would be able to make recommendations to the medical board and to the Division of Occupational, Professional, and Business Professional Corporations and Business Licensing. So we would basically be making a recommendation to the division and to the medical board itself. That would probably be handled, that would probably be passed to them through their executive administrator.
So that's the similarity of the Bar Association with, say, a commission or a board, in that they're the ones that will police those licensed in the state of Alaska to practice law, basically.
Yes, and they determine who actually can practice. I mean, they do act as a licensing agency.
So is there a similar type of rule that, let's just say you have some person feels that their legal representative did not represent them well, or was somehow improperly treating their case, they would go to the Bar Association. They felt like the Bar Association didn't hear them. What would be their next recourse?
To the chair, the next recourse at this point would be, there's a couple of layers of review within the Bar Association, and then after that they can actually ask the Alaska Supreme Court to review the matter. So it is it's not a particularly easy route to take, but they can go to the Alaska Supreme Court, which has reserved the power over disciplinary matters. Ultimately, if an attorney is going to be disbarred, the Alaska Supreme Court signs off on that. And so they've also agreed to hear petitions about a grievance that has been rejected.
Well, today's first I'd heard that they had the court rules that had an unusual circumstance to them. It's been my understanding, though, that it's a dues-paying organization. It's a creature established by the legislature, but it's managed, as I understand it, by the Supreme Court as far as oversight. So in drilling down through it, if we said it was a state agency, that wouldn't necessarily be correct, because there's no state funding the way I understand it. Is that correct?
Well, that's a call that the legislature will ultimately have to make, because it's true they do not receive state funding, which makes them much less like a state agency. On the other hand, they conduct a state licensing function, you know. And so, as I said, the lack of public funding is one of the factors that favors them not being a state agency. What they do for the state of Alaska as a licensing entity looks a lot more like a state agency. The factors are mixed.
So, yeah, and that creates an interesting conundrum, because those lawyers who will become judges quite often then have somehow a membership within this, if I understand correctly.
Well, it is a mandatory bar association, so it's you cannot practice You cannot be a lawyer and practice legally here without being a member. It is not a voluntary organization.
So to make the correlation, it would be like legislators being the only ones sitting on the Legislative Ethics Committee in many ways. You have all barred lawyers, including judges, sitting somehow in oversight of the of this particular agency, right, or actually association.
To the chair, by statute, I believe that three members of the Board of Governors of the Bar Association are public members appointed by the governor. So it isn't quite that, isn't quite so, but.
Well, that's nice to know. This is a little bit of a new world for me, so I'm asking kind of the questions I think that probably any citizen might ask is, okay, how does that work? If I have a problem with the Bar Association, I have to go to the Bar Association to tell me that I don't have a problem with them, right? And I think that's why I'm asking if there's another avenue besides the Ombudsman. Because the way I understand the Ombudsman is we have allowed this as one avenue to look into grievances that citizens have to say that if an agency or, in this particular case, the association is not serving their purpose with to the letter of the law and with integrity, that somehow somebody would know that. And you work with a lot of confidential information throughout, so that doesn't seem a problem. Then it's just a matter of the authority to reach in, is what I understand.
To the chair, it is a matter of making it clear that we have that authority, and I'd be happy to provide the committee with the analysis that we did of basically the history of the issue and what the potential pitfalls are regarding the bar rules versus the Ombudsman Act. I'd be happy to provide that material to the committee.
That would be good. Just for people's information, I do have Tracy Wallenberg from the Public Defenders Agency. I have Steve Van Gore, Alaska Bar Association, on. They're willing to answer questions. But Steve, you also said that you would like to testify. Is there anything on this particular issue that you'd like to chime in on?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly agree with the analysis that that Beth has given in terms of the oversight that we currently have. If a person makes a complaint about a lawyer and disagrees with something my office does, that person can have our decision reviewed by a member of our Board of Governors who serves as our liaison. The liaison pretty much has a blank check to basically say, you know, do this over again, investigate this particular allegation, and so forth. And then, as Beth was just talking about, if a complainant still disagrees, they can go directly to the Supreme Court on an original application and have the court look at the entire file. And so there is definitely oversight what we do at an investigative level, but certainly the bar rules themselves outline a very specific path for the investigation of complaints and the prosecution of unethical conduct. These rules were established by the court under the constitutional authority that the court received under Article 4, Section 1, and the process has been working. Talking about oversight in general, I think it's important for the committee to remember that the Legislative Audit Division conducts regular performance audits of the Bar Association and has been doing that since 1980. Every one of those audits has recommended continuation of the bar. We certainly pay attention to the recommendations that are made by a legislative audit, but I think it's important to remember that legislative audit has recommended and the legislature has approved the continued existence of the Bar Association as an agency responsible for the admission and discipline of lawyers. In general, we're responsible to all three branches. We're responsible to the legislative branch under legislative audit. We're responsible to the governor. As Beth pointed out, the governor appoints three public members on our 12-person board. And, of course, we're also accountable to the Alaska Supreme Court for following these rules. The dozen or so matters that Beth talked about I think it's consistent with the interactions we've had with the Ombudsman's Office over the years. But I think it's important for the committee to understand that in that same time period, I counted 3,079 matters that the Bar Association looked at and was responsible for processing. So the universe, I guess, of folks who have gone to the Ombudsman's Office with these concerns is very, very small. Ironically, subjecting our confidential investigations, confidential under Supreme Court rule investigations, would have an adverse public policy effect. If lawyers realized that their answers to a client's complaints could be made public, they would be less likely to give a full and candid explanation of what they did. Now, it's important to understand that sometimes a lawyer has to defend himself or herself by explaining things that would ordinarily be only known between the lawyer and the client. But it's important for our office to know exactly what the lawyer did and to have that sort of candor. And I think the Public Defender Agency, and I know Tracy Wallenberg is on the line as well, has a significant concern here because, quite frankly, a lot of the complaints that we get at the bar office come from individuals who are concerned about their public defenders. Public defenders, by and large, respond completely to these investigations, provide the necessary information to allow us to decide whether or not a problem occurred. If they understand or they believe that those candid explanations, including client confidential information, could be publicly disclosed, they may be less likely to provide that information out of a concern for an adverse effect on the client, even though the client is complaining about their conduct. So, overall, we are subject to review by all three branches of government in the ways that I described. I hate to say that we would have to take this issue up to the Supreme Court if this provision was adopted, but we're between a rock and a hard place, candidly, Mr. Chairman. We have confidentiality rules adopted by the court that we must follow. If we were subpoenaed for files by the Ombudsman's Office, we'd have to go directly to the fifth floor and ask the Supreme Court to resolve the issue because we don't have the ability to waive confidentiality ourselves. So I'd be happy to answer any further questions in that area, but I think Beth has clearly identified the issues that face her organization. Hopefully I've identified the issues that face my organization. Frankly, I think the way to solve this is to answer the Ombudsman's question by saying that the Bar Association is not an agency subject to their jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I guess for me, Steve, the question I will continually have ringing in my ears is, the ability for an individual to make a complaint is so hard when you're looking at the daunting task of trying to figure out government. And to say to an individual in Alaska, your recourse is to go to the Supreme Court, is even more daunting in my view. So help me understand a little bit about how an individual would go and move through a claim to at least satisfying their knowledge that a good due process has happened.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the two most common complaints that the Bar Association receives about a lawyer's conduct are neglect and failure to communicate. You could substitute the words poor customer service. Now, what we do when we get a complaint is that we make sure that it meets the minimum requirements. It has to be in writing. It has to be verified at the bottom. And we have to have enough information to focus on what the person is concerned about. If it meets those very basic requirements, we immediately send that complaint to the lawyer and ask the lawyer to provide a response. This is our intake process. And by and large, in the intake process, the response is voluntary on the part of the lawyer, but the lawyers typically do provide a response that gives us information to decide, is this something that we need to be concerned about? Now, under the rules, we have a responsibility to prove that misconduct occurred by clear and convincing evidence. Now, I know as members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, you're familiar with the general standards for civil cases, which is a preponderance of evidence. Clear and convincing evidence is obviously a higher standard than that. Not quite beyond a reasonable doubt that you find in criminal cases, but still a reasonable standard. I mean, a standard above the preponderance of evidence standard. A lot of times, what lawyers don't realize is that clients are upset when they don't get their phone calls returned. And believe me, Mr. Chairman, we preach this every opportunity we get when we do continuing legal education programs. Neglect and failure to communicate are the most preventable types of complaints that lawyers get. All they have to do is basically resolve to respond to a client's concerns, to respond to a client's complaints, even if they have to give the client the bad news. You know, I didn't do what I promised, but I will make an effort to get it done. I'm sorry it's taking longer than it should, you know, and so forth. Again, coming back to this idea of customer service. Now, a lot of times when we've gotten that information from the lawyer, we send it to the complainant and ask for any further comments that the complainant has. A lot of times we get those comments, and then we make a decision. Is this something that we ought to accept for formal investigation? If it's a minor matter, a minor incident of neglect or failure to communicate, and the lawyer has explained what's happened, we'll decide not to open an investigation, but at the same time, we'll provide a full explanation in the vast majority of these situations of why we decided not to open an investigation. Now, I am anxious to point out that we do more than a lot of jurisdictions do in this respect. Some jurisdictions will basically say, you know, it came in, we looked at it, there was nothing to it, you know, goodbye and good luck. The two attorneys that we have who focus their practice in the bar office on investigating complaints will provide an explanation to the complainant why we didn't open an investigation and so forth. Now, there are folks that are still going to be unhappy, even with an explanation from the lawyer, even with an explanation from the bar. Those people will have their files reviewed by the board liaison, as I said a few seconds ago. The liaison has the ability to basically say, open this for investigation, investigate these allegations, and so forth. Now, the part that Beth was talking about in terms of Supreme Court review and that you were just talking about, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to candy coat it as, you know, something that is real easy to do. An original application basically requires a person to make an application to the court and ask the court to review the decision that the Bar Association made on a complaint. We've had, since the Anderson decision, which gave the court, in which the court said that they had the authority to do that, we probably had a dozen or more of those matters gone to the Supreme Court. And I can tell you that the folks that are concerned about a decision that know that they can go to the Supreme Court have gone to the Supreme Court, and they have been heard by the Supreme Court. When the court accepts a matter for original review, we send our entire file to the Supreme Court. We're responsible for responding to the allegations that the person has made to the Supreme Court. So it's by no means a process where, you know, nobody is listening. Obviously, somebody is listening. The Supreme Court is listening. The Supreme Court is asking us for explanations, and we provide explanations.
So, Steve.
And so, yes, I'm sorry.
Just two questions. What is the kind of the standard issue or this type of issue, maybe that would be a better way of saying it, that would end up under original review, and what does original review mean as a term of art?
It's an original application. It's under the appellate rules. It basically is a request for review by the court that doesn't conveniently follow fall into other categories in the appellate rules, Mr. Chairman. It's not a direct appeal, for example. It's not a petition for review. It's not a petition for hearing. In other words, it's an original matter subject to the court's authority in which a person asks the court to review the action. So it's one of the ways set out in the appellate rules that a person can have something reviewed by the court.
Thank you. And what are some of the types of issues that would end up under that kind of a review?
Well, the types of issues, again, would be that the lawyer failed to communicate with a client or neglected a client matter.
So it wouldn't, but, it wouldn't necessarily be, you know, an ethical question or some question of standard rules of procedure or things like that. It wouldn't be criminal behavior or looking for extra money based on, you know, supposed billings?
Well, there are a couple of questions in there, Mr. Chairman. First of all, most of the complaints that we get alleging neglect and failure to communicate come from two areas of practice. Domestic relations practice, where I can promise you after a long time doing this kind of job, there are no happy people at all on either side. But the majority of our complaints come from prisoners who are complaining about ineffective assistance of their lawyers in their representations in court. Under the rules of court, these people have the ability to ask for a post-conviction relief. It's a process in which their representation that they were provided is reviewed by the court, and action can be taken to address any shortcomings on the part of the lawyer. A lot of times, these individuals, I think, are under the mistaken belief that if they file a complaint, it automatically results in some sort of action with their case. It does not. We have the ability to take licensing action against a defense lawyer who doesn't do his or her job, but that doesn't automatically translate into some relief for the person in their criminal case. And what we do when we get those kinds of complaints is tell them you need to file, pursue your remedies for post-conviction relief, direct appeal, and so forth. Now, a lot of times people disagree with that. They think that we ought not to be deferring to those two different procedures, and they will go to the liaison, and then they will go to the court. But I think to answer your question, again, the most common complaints are neglect and failure to communicate. There are certain things that lawyers do that are unique to the legal profession that wouldn't apply to anybody else. For example, communicating with a client that the lawyer knows to be represented by another lawyer. Well, you know, there's nothing preventing people from talking to each other, but if a lawyer knowingly talks to a client that the lawyer knows is represented by another lawyer, that's an ethics issue. And depending on what has happened in those communications, those are the kinds of issues, rule violations, that we would formally investigate and formally prosecute. Mr. Chairman, the cases that you see in the newspaper, the box ads that are in the four major newspapers around the state that describe why a lawyer was suspended or disbarred, involve conduct that nobody's going to have any question about. Lying, cheating, stealing, you know, that sort of thing. And it's unfortunate that the bar, like any other profession, has to deal with that 1% or 2% of its membership that is inclined to involve themselves in that sort of activity. Those are the cases that are the most serious. Those are the cases that have the greatest impact on clients, on the court system, and the legal profession as a whole. And so those are the matters that we must focus our attention on. But I want to assure you that if the liaison indicates that an investigation should be opened, certainly if the Supreme Court indicates that an investigation should be opened, that's exactly what will happen. by way of a footnote, the court has yet to reverse a decision after reviewing our files, saying that we've done something inappropriate. But that isn't to say that the court doesn't have the authority to do that and can do that in the future.
Steve, thank you very much. Give me some very thorough, thought-provoking ideas. You know, the question for us as we look at the Ombudsman Bill is, you know, the Bar Association obviously is the single place for credentialing to practice law, and yet the state seems to have a hand in it without us getting a chance to look into it. So that was one of my big concerns. I wanted to kind of reach in and figure out what the grievance process was. It sounds like you guys handle it with the utmost integrity. I don't know that I have a problem with it, but I just wanted to ask all the kind of what-if questions that a non-lawyer would ask. Now I have a lawyer who wants to ask a question.
Actually, I don't want to. I don't have a question. I do just want to declare, Mr. Chair, that I am a member of the Bar Association.
Yeah. And I won't pick on you too much. I've sat on the Judiciary Committee for a lot of years with people who are lawyers, and I've heard many, many statements on, you know, being, you know, what that actual, that license means. So it's a big deal to the people of Alaska. So if there's any last comments you want to make, Mr. Van Gore, this would be the chance to do it, because I'm going to set this aside at this point, let people kind of chew on it, but I wanted to have this conversation right up front.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I don't have anything further to add, right, but I'm happy to answer any other questions the committee has.
All right. Thank you. And what we'll do is we'll set this bill aside. I just wanted it kind of introduced. It took a little longer than I thought. I wanted to allow some time for Senate Joint Resolution number 9. But that was kind of the one of the ticklish questions that we wanted to ask. Thank you for your comment. Linda Lord-Jenkins, was there any last things that you wanted to put on before I set this aside for the next hearing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I think that you've been covering things very well. I do again want to stress that we are just looking for legislative guidance on this particular question and a couple of the questions that are proposed in the bill relating to contract facilities, but I'm sure we will be talking about those at the next hearing.
Yep. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We're going to set this bill aside now for the next hearing. I just thanks for indulging me to ask the questions. Those are questions that just came to my mind as I was thinking about why aren't they a state agency? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for all listening in. Beth, for presenting the bill. And now what I would like to do is I'd like to bring Senate Joint Resolution number 9 before us today. Senate Joint Resolution number 9 we've already had a couple of hearings. My apologies. We had one committee set up during the time that we were debating the tax bill on the floor. And so that brings SJR 9. Now, last time we finished up with the commissioner before us. If you want to have further questions, I asked the commissioner if he'd be here today. I actually had three people who wanted to testify that are in the room. I was open to bringing them up. Unless the committee has anything they want to say up front, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, whatever point is would be appropriate, Mr. Chair. I did just have a couple more questions for the commissioner.
All right. They're all teachers. One is Maureen Von Wagner from East High School, is what it says, and Tim Parker with Lathrop High School, and Todd Hindman, principal at Anvil Science Academy. All three of you here? All right. If you want to come give your testimony, I would like to keep it as limited, as tight as I can, but why don't you come on forward, give your state your name on record, and yeah, come up. Both of you grab a seat, and then you just move the microphone around as you wish. And thanks for coming before the committee. Give your name, your affiliation. I just gave it to you, but for the record, for those who are recording it.
Okay. My name is Maureen Van Wagner. I am a special education teacher who happens to be a Republican. I teach at the largest school in the state, East High School. I have been teaching for 17 years, and I am gravely concerned and stand in opposition to SJR 9. I'm already expected to do more with less, as the BSA has not seen an increase since 2010. These bills will only continue that trend, making my job of teaching emotionally and behaviorally disturbed students even more difficult. These bills are being presented with no viable plan of implementation. I do not now, or nor I ever, support public tax dollars, my tax dollars, to fund private schools. Bottom line, voucher programs do not increase choice for parents, because it's the private schools that will ultimately decide whether to admit the student. Thank you for giving me this time. I appreciate it.
Maureen, thank you very much for taking the time to come in and testify. Is it Tim?
Yep. Tim Parker, thank you. I'm a teacher at Lathrop High School in Fairbanks. I've been a teacher there for 15 years. I was the 2007 VP Teacher of the Year for Fairbanks, and I very much like education issues. And so this one, I'm all for education issues that improve student learning. So if we were talking about education issues that improve student learning, I'm for them, and I think the majority of teachers in this state would be for them. But unfortunately, SJR 9, I don't believe improves student learning. I don't think there's a tie-in from that to improving student learning for public school students around the state. The majority of students obviously attend public school, and they would see no benefit. Other states that have tried vouchers have often seen decreases in the amount of funding that goes towards public education. That would make it very challenging to do some of the things that we want to do, and we're trying to do things a little bit differently to remove some of the funding based on a voucher program or some other program that might come out of opening up the Constitution. Research on vouchers has not been good. Vouchers have been around for quite a while, and they have not been proven to show improved student learning in the areas where they actually are being used. In Milwaukee, they've been used for over 20 years, and you do not see a drastic increase in student performance based on the use of vouchers. If they did, we'd have to be talking a different story, but they don't. School choice, I often hear this sort of spun in that direction as if it's a school choice issue. We have a lot of public school choice in this state. I actually am proud of this state for the different public school choices that we have. Of course, we have traditional community public schools. We have charter schools. We have distance delivery programs of different kinds, and we even have homeschools that all fall within the public realm. There are lots of choices in the state. And in order to be a public school of that nature, of course, you have to have certified teachers. You have to meet all the accountability guidelines that we have, and you have to accept all the students that walk in the front door. And at Lathrop High School, where I teach, that's one of the best things about the school. No matter who shows up, you live in that area. We're there to help you, and we're there to do it. We don't turn you away. We don't say, I'm sorry, you know, you're not part of our, you know, religious denomination or our private focus that we're working on at this point in time. We take everyone. So what would improve student learning if this bill doesn't do that, or this constitutional joint resolution doesn't do that? Well, as a teacher in the state who's very interested in raising the bar and trying to get us towards a very professional look for all of us, you know, there are ideas out there, and we've put together, NEA Alaska has put together a six principles idea that I hope many of you have seen, just briefly highlighted. Professional learning communities, we're very interested in those. Peer review, extra time for students. We like the evaluation system. You know, the commissioner's here, and we've spent a lot of time working with the commissioner on the evaluation system and some of the proposals there. We like some of those changes. I mean, some of those changes are good and healthy and needed in our system. We don't like all of them, but we like some of them. Family-school partnerships, we're very much in favor of trying to figure out ways that we can get schools and families together. The more that parents are in the schools, the better the school is every time. And invite all of you to come to schools. And finally, delivering a rich and varied curriculum. As we focus very hard on tests these days, there's a good chance, and you see it around the country, of art, sciences, and physical education sort of being left on the wayside. That's not good for student learning in the long run. So once again, for any ideas that have to do with student learning, that can show demonstrated student learning increases, we're for them. But this bill in its current form and the opening up of the Constitution to private and religious schools, I don't think it meets that threshold. Thank you very much.
Senator Dyson had a question.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you both and the passion you have for kids. Jim, in Fairbanks, I want to just give me a rough idea on two things. I think there's a private school there, Monroe.
Yes.
How do they compare with academic achievement with Lathrop? And then do you know how much they spend per student at Monroe?
I don't have their spending data, and since they don't take comparable tests or share that test data with us, I really couldn't tell you how they compare necessarily.
Thank
with
you.
Us, so, sorry.
Right. Thank you too very much. We really appreciate it. And Todd, is it?
Todd Heinemann.
Hindman?
Heinemann.
Heinemann, okay.
My name is Todd Heinemann, and I'm the principal teacher at Anvil City Science Academy, a charter school in its 15th year of operation in Nome. ACSA has and continues to provide choice for parents in Nome, as have many other charter schools throughout Alaska, all within the public school system. Our current charter school statute continues to produce innovative programs that are increasing choices for Alaska families. That is why I am opposed to SJR 9. SJR 9 and its implications have reminded me of a fear I heard from legislators a few years ago when I testified on behalf of SB 57, a bill which provided equity and funding for small charter schools. That fear was that the passage of SB 57 would lead to the formation of a multitude of small charter schools which would dilute the funding for existing programs. If public funds are allowed to be used for religious and private educational institutions, public dollars would be diluted and public school students would be negatively impacted. Thank you.
Thank you. Also, we have the prime sponsor here. Was there anything? I have one other to testify, and then I was going to have the commissioner come back forward. All right. We have the commissioner. And I think you had a couple of questions for him yet. Senator Wilk,
yes, I do.
Commissioner, thanks for coming back to the committee today. I really appreciate it. Just put yourself on the record. And
for the record, I'm Mike Hanley. I'm the commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you very much. I think Senator Wilkowski had a question for you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been a list. There were a list of examples, questions out there. About some state expenditures that are being made. Do you believe there are currently any state expenditures being made that are unconstitutional for any of the institutions of learning?
Through the chair, not that I'm aware of. We monitor our correspondence schools. We have seen some areas that we have felt were unconstitutional. We've corrected those. But I don't think I could just look the other way if I felt that they were unconstitutional.
So in your opinion, we don't need to pass this because there's some unconstitutional monies, state monies being expended?
Through the chair, I'm not sure that what I just spoke about, that where I believe were constitutional expenditures, matches up with the expectation of this bill. I guess I would need clarification from you on what expenditures you're speaking to that I found constitutional.
I can give you there's a list of things in the sponsor packet.
Yeah, there was like the Advantage, there was the Advantage Scholarship Program.
Right.
There was, I think, about a half a dozen of them that may be even outside of your purview. I don't know.
Chair Coghill, that really has been a legal decision along the lines of the Performance Scholarship and the Alaska Advantage Program that really would be a legal counsel would be best to answer that.
Do you believe those are, or have you gotten legal advice that those are constitutional or unconstitutional, those expenditures?
Through the chair, in conversations I've had, they've been deemed constitutional.
Are you aware of any of these expenditures that are being made by the state for educational purposes that are unconstitutional?
Through the chair, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And then,
yes, and Senator McGuire has a question. Okay, so how far?
I'll pause right there.
All right. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Just a couple questions. I guess my first question is, with charter schools, when Senate Bill 57, as was referred to earlier, passed the legislature and then went into effect and regulations were written, I guess I'm trying to understand, was it through the regulatory process, if you know, or the statutory process, that things like school size and some of the safety nets with respect to requiring that charter schools comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act and OSHA and those other things, were those put in as a result of regulations or were they put in as a result of statute?
Through the chair, primarily statute. Charter schools in Alaska are functions of local school districts, so they are, in essence, no different than a traditional neighborhood school. So they are an additional school. They may have an additional focus by definition, but their organization, their governance is identical to that of a neighborhood school.
Okay. And then just to follow up, if I might, through the chair,
yes.
Let's say that the legislature puts this bill through to voters this year or next year, and voters agree that they would like to have school choice. And then, of course, that has to come back then for implementation, either in the form of statutes, regulations, or both, I would assume both. Is it your belief that any kind of a voucher program that would involve handing out of public money would require regulations to be written that would ask a school that would accept public money to comply with OSHA requirements and Americans with Disability Act requirements?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of the OSHA particular qualifications, but IDEA, yes, which is the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act, and other federal non-discriminatory language. So, yes, they would need to meet those. I spoke previously to our responsibilities as a state and specifically as a department in regards to establishing and maintaining a system of public education. And that's been defined by the courts in four ways, one of those being oversight and support, one being creating standards, assessments for those standards, and funding. So it becomes difficult. It would be difficult for me as a commissioner for our department and as a state if there weren't some accountability measures that went to these private institutions. It becomes difficult for me to meet my constitutional obligations in those areas that have been defined if there's no oversight, if there's no common standards. So that really becomes a discussion for the legislature if that were to move forward.
Senator McGuire. And thank you. And I think, and the reason I'm asking these questions is because I think it's important, however it is that each individual voter might choose to vote on this, and whatever our opinions are, I certainly support a strong public education system. I certainly support a strong system of education. But I think it's important that as we move forward, we really don't get fear wrapped up in it. And we really think about what school choice would mean if we were to do it. And I certainly, as a public policymaker, remember the charter school debate and some of the fears that were there, and know that in reality, that if there are public funds that go into any kind of an educational system, certainly there would be strings attached with respect to requirements of federal law and standards. And so this notion that any school could spring up touting whatever belief system it wanted and not allowing those with disabilities in, or those of only one color of skin, those kinds of arguments that I've been hearing, I think I just wanted to put those to rest, that certainly whomever would be the Commissioner of Education working with the members of the legislature would put together a package of statutes and regulations that would ensure that Alaskans would have a legal system of school choice that would be implemented. And then my last point that I wanted to make and ask you about is this idea that if we allowed school choice, that somehow the public school system would reach a demise. And I guess I ask you, I take an oath every year to uphold my Constitution every time I'm sworn in. And I take that very seriously. And I think as a commissioner, you take a similar set of oaths and principles. And I guess my question would be for you, could you envision a circumstance where voters would agree, Alaskans would agree, that there was school choice and vouchers were used by parents and some chose private institutions and charter schools and other things, that we would allow, or you would allow, as Commissioner of Education, for the public schools in the state of Alaska in urban and rural areas to erode to the point of being non-functional?
Through the chair, I think that that's a dual responsibility between the legislature and the Department of Education, who the legislature has given responsibility for maintaining and establishing that system. But I think we do have an obligation to adequately fund. One of our primary constitutional responsibilities is to adequately fund and maintain our system of education. So I think we would need to look at that and say we wouldn't open a system that would allow funding to go elsewhere while we allowed our public school system to fall into disrepair or not adequately meet the needs of our students in that system. I think we would have that responsibility for all students.
Last question.
Yes.
Thank you, and through the chair. And I guess my last question on that point is that I think a lot of, you know, the public doesn't always understand how much micromanaging goes on within departments via the regulation process and how much oversight goes on in the legislative process, that policies are made with respect to charter schools, big change ideas, but that it's not that they're sort of thrown out there and then left, that we come back and we continually reflect, that no one that I know that I serve with wants to see failure. And so I guess I ask this, could one idea be that there would be a protected base amount, for example, that would be constitutionally, I guess you'd say not constitutionally, but to meet the constitutional requirement for public education, be set aside for public institutions, a base amount for those public institutions that exist within urban and rural areas?
Through the chair, that surely is a possibility, and that responsibility for funding squarely falls with the legislature to have that conversation of maintenance of education.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski, I interrupted you earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions, and following up on the questions from Senator McGuire, on because I've heard this concern as well on children with special needs and disabilities, and what is your understanding of the law? What is your understanding of what would happen? I mean, would if this were to pass and we were to go to a voucher system, could a school choose that was accepting vouchers at private school not to accept kids with disabilities or special needs? Or would there be a state requirement that they accept those children?
Through the chair, it really comes back to a legal conversation, but we owe all of our students a free and appropriate public education by law and our moral obligations as well. So I would believe that we would need to have open access to our schools. Again, I'm not the lawyer to make the final determination on that, but it would be my expectation that a free and appropriate public education, and if funding goes to a private school, they are a part of our public education system because they're funded with public dollars. So I would have the same expectations.
One of the fundamental questions that I had to ask when I looked at this bill to begin with was, are we funding schools or are we funding students? And I think what we see here is we're allowing students to pick schools. And so because we're still leaving in the language of the constitutional amendment that schools and institutions shall be free from sectarian control. So I think we're not funding schools. The way I understand this bill is we're really allowing students to take their funding with them. And that is the fundamental policy question here. Can students take the funding with them? Then it's a matter of how far can we reach with the requirements with that funding requirement. Do I understand it correctly from this perspective?
Chair Coghill, that seems to be my understanding and the reason why things like the performance scholarship could go to a school as a faith-based, right. A faith-based school, because the funding is a function of the students.
So for the last few minutes, we've asked a lot of what-if questions, because really we're trying to find our way through. If we have an open debate in our state, the what-if questions have to be asked. And so I wanted to make sure that we put them on the table. But the reality is these create the what-if questions. You can't even have that what-if question without this debate, in my view. So, Senator Wilkowski, I just wanted to make sure that we were talking about funding the students, not the school. When he spoke, I wanted to make sure I think I corrected that.
Right. Well, we're giving the money to the students, but then we're allowing them to use that funding for potentially religious institutions. I think the vast majority of private schools are religious institutions, and so what we'd essentially be doing as a state is creating a policy where people could use that money for religious purposes. I mean, a lot of the schools are for purposes of indoctrinating kids in a certain religion. I'm not saying that in a bad way. What if there's taxpayers out there who have very strong beliefs that they don't want their funding to go to a particular religious school? Is there any recourse for them?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that.
That would actually be part of the debate we have in committee, because I can just tell you there are taxpayers right now who feel very strongly about everything from creationism to all of these different things, including sex education in our own public schools. And so the answer is yes, there's going to be strong feelings.
Right, but as a taxpayer, we don't fund churches.
Unless you regard secular humanism as a non-church issue, and in fact it is, but it's also a philosophy that is the only accepted philosophy in many cases.
We don't fund organized churches, Mr. Chair.
I understand. But I just wanted to throw that out as part of the conversation. It'll be in the broader public conversation.
Right. But we would be going to a policy where we would be allowing people to take money which would inevitably fund religious institutions which are teaching kids various beliefs, pro-Catholic, anti-Catholic, pro-Jewish, anti-Jewish. Are there any sort of parameters that you envision putting in place to not allow particular religious beliefs, church, maybe schools that teach particular beliefs, to not receive funding?
Through the chair, no. I have not considered that. And in regards to this constitutional amendment to allow this opportunity to go to the people for a vote, no, I haven't really gone that far to. I think that would be equally problematic or more problematic to say for the state to determine we like this, but we don't like that school.
And I think that brings us really to the point that I'd like to get the sponsor to come and respond to, because I think some of the genesis of this can come from the sponsor as well. So why don't we go ahead and have the sponsor come forward? And I think the line of questions, the last couple of questions, I can bring him back if you have a specific question. But on this particular line of questions, kind of the what-if questions, really anticipated probably more properly by the sponsor than the commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can what if for
just identify yourself.
Senator Mike Dunleavy, sponsor of SJR 9. We can what if for long periods of time, and I'm more than happy to do that. I just I don't think the bill's about what ifs, though. There's been questions about directly funding religious and private schools. I would, and I've been on the record saying I'm not for that. As a matter of fact, I think the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution would have some real issues with that. Direct funding. In Zelman in 2002, the Cleveland case, 5-4 Supreme Court ruling was that if money went to children, and the families decide where the child's going to receive educational services, that's constitutional. There's a lot of question here about intent and what ifs and what could be's. I mean, there could be a whole number of things that could happen if folks wanted it to happen. SJR 9 for me is not being afraid of what the people of the state of Alaska want. I'm not afraid of them making choices. I'm not afraid of them making decisions on their own constitution. A lot of what I'm hearing here recently is that we have to protect ourselves from ourselves. We have to protect ourselves from our own good intentions or could be ill intentions. This Constitution belongs to the people. This educational system belongs to the people. These children belong to their families. And, you know, there could be all kinds of what-ifs. But if you're asking me what my intent is not to fund religious or private schools directly. That's not my intent. I don't think that would be a good thing. I think Senator Wilkowski brings up some very good points that I agree with. When you, if you want to do a, quote, voucher, and that's what this bill has been tagged with, is the voucher bill. If you want to do a, quote, voucher, you're better off doing that through a tax credit. That's an 11-person vote in the Senate and a 21-person vote in the House. Much easier to do. And that's where a lot of states and municipalities all over the country are going, is tax credits. Because then there's no public money. It's private money going to where private money wants it to go. Then there's no argument along the lines of what Senator Wilkowski is saying. There were a number of questions asked of the commissioner. In all fairness, the commissioner is not a lawyer. Yeah. And he's trying to think, you know, what could be or what ifs or what this. I don't want to sound silly, but I was told if I bought a snow machine, I'd freeze to death. I could have frozen to death, but it didn't turn out that way. I was told if I got a dog, I'd get bit. Didn't happen. I was told if I had children, they'd break my heart. That hasn't happened either. So, I mean, we can do the what ifs, but the idea is SGR 9 will allow us to do the things we're doing now. If you look in the packet, there is legal thought. I don't want to say advice or rendering. Legal thought from Ledge Counsel. There's also information there from an AG report in 2005, all which lends itself to the idea that we'll never know unless we're sued, or we'll never know unless there's a court action. But we're certainly engaged in practices that many folks believe cross the line between giving public money to private and sectarian educational entities. By virtue of having a correspondence school that allows children to purchase a course in BYU, which, as we know, is Brigham Young University and it's Mormon-based, some would argue that you are crossing the line. For some that use thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to get tutorial services at Sylvan, Sylvan is private and for profit. We've crossed the line. So many folks think we've crossed the line. Other folks, maybe not. You never know until there's court action. But the problem with that is, as we expand these programs and thousands of Alaskans are involved with them, if somebody wants to file a suit, whether it be the ACLU or any group or any individual, those programs could grind to a halt. What do you do with those families? What do you do with those kids? What do you do with those people that have become dependent upon those programs? You heard Nussbaum testify at the last meeting for some time. Talked about our Constitution, talked about the three court actions, which have narrowly defined what we can and can't do. We can continue to do what we're doing and take a risk. We're probably not going to be able to expand programs in the public-private partnerships. The intent that I had, and I've been very clear on it, is to have a broader, wider public education system where there is a public outcome and there's public accountability. So, I mean, again, we can, again, the dog, yeah, it could have bit me. I haven't been bit yet by my dog. I have five of them. They haven't bit me. They could, and they could do a lot of other things, but that hasn't happened. Snow machine, I haven't froze to death. Boat, I haven't drowned. A lot of things can happen. But here's the bottom line for me, and I think just something for you to ponder. This is the Constitution for the people. This is the people's Constitution. It's their educational system. It's their kids. I've heard questions or statements, well, what happens if they, you know, if they take some of their money and they go to a religious school? They might hear religion. Don't you think the parents know where their kids are going to school? Or there's a special ed child that may be going to an educational entity that may not have these protections, these federal protections. Don't you think the parents know this if they're engaged in sending their children to these schools? So this idea that we're protecting parents and we're protecting children from themselves is kind of an odd concept for me. And I would rather let the people of Alaska make the decision as to whether they need us to protect them from themselves, to be honest with you. You have before you a poll. Some will, that came out of the House, some will question the poll, some will question the poll questions, et cetera, et cetera. But no matter how you look at it, it would appear, and there was a poll done last year, that the people of Alaska wouldn't mind having an opportunity to vote on their constitution regarding this issue. So I guess the decision before you is, do you protect the people of Alaska from themselves, or do you allow them to make a decision on their constitution, their children, their educational system? I prefer to throw my lot in with the people of Alaska, and I would hope you do so as well.
Any questions, Senator Wilkowski?
Yes. I guess I would be remiss in not noting that the numerous times this body has overturned the will of the people through legislative initiatives. Just recently, just a couple weeks ago, the people voted on a cruise ship initiative, and we overturned it, right?
Through the chair, was that a constitutional issue? Was that a constitutional amendment, or was that a voter initiative?
That was a voter initiative where the people voted on something, and the legislature said, we reject what you said.
And through the chair...
I mean, not to get into an argument.
Through the chair, but, I think you said at that time it was wrong to do that, but now you're saying it's right to do that, if I'm hearing you correctly.
What I'm saying is, you're the one saying we should honor the will of the people.
Yes.
When this body just voted to overturn the will of the people, just a couple weeks ago. So, on to my next question, which is, I don't know if you're the person or if the commissioner's the person, but what's the interplay with the municipalities and local communities? In other words, if the state decides we should have a voucher program, should the munis be, are the munis required to participate in that? Could a municipality say, we don't want to be a part of this? What's the sort of interplay with that?
Again, I'm not necessarily a constitutional lawyer, but... I think that would have to be a discussion that takes place. Vouchers don't come in one form. For example, through the chair, we currently have an allotment program through our homeschool correspondence program. Some would call that a tuition program. Some would call that a scholarship program, voucher program. You call it whatever you want. But it's public monies going to the hands of families and children to decide, make educational decisions, and make educational purchases. That does not seem to have, at least at this point, run afoul of any municipal codes that I'm aware of. But again, Senator Wilkowski, how this looks or how any future program comes out of it, that's a discussion for the Senate, the legislature, and the governor. I would say, though, again, that practices that I'm concerned about, that what we're doing now, and I was part of a homeschool correspondence program that really opened my eyes to this whole idea. We're engaged in practices now. And this is, we're not even talking about labor money that's going, or money that's going to private labor organizations for training. We're not talking about necessarily the Advantage Scholarship or the Governor's Scholarship that has money going to individuals to go to religious-based colleges. We're not even talking about that, although some question whether those are constitutional. And again, we won't know unless we're sued. But I would say what we currently do, the municipalities, I'm not sure if they have an issue with what we're doing currently. I haven't heard.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, another question. If someone felt very strongly that they didn't want their public dollars to be used for a particular religious institution or for any religious institution, what is there any recourse for that person or for that homeowner that their taxpayer money is going for?
Religion? And I don't know the answer to that. I haven't heard anyone. I have not heard of any suits or anyone complaining, for example, that the city of Wasilla or Palmer, for example, or Anchorage, runs a sewer line right up to a church, which is a direct benefit to a church. I haven't heard of anyone trying to get their tax money back for that or for clearing the sidewalk in front of a church or clearing the road or police protection, fire protection for a church. I haven't heard of any cases like that, so I don't know the answer to that.
But to get back to this particular, you know, the real question is, if the state gave public funds to the direct educational benefit of the student,
mm-hmm.
it would really be the student's choices or the family at that point.
Yes.
It would be the choices that we'd have to get to there, and could we direct their choices? It looks to me like that's more the question.
I would say possibly. That's a discussion that can happen, but please keep in mind, what I'm suggesting is really an expansion of the public education system. That's what I'm advocating for. You give a kid a dollar, you give a family a dollar, we demand a public outcome. We demand that the kids are accountable in the assessment. We demand the kids are accountable to the standards. And my view would be, if the kids are passing the assessments and the kids are proficient or better, we don't mess with them. So the how they got there, that's really what the question is. But this is not an open-ended, quote, voucher system, and that's why I don't even use the term voucher. It's not an open-ended voucher system where, by God, you pass the Constitution, all hell breaks loose, you give a family some money, and they disappear and they give it to a church. My concept is, again, it's an expanded public education system where you take the dollar, like we currently do with the homeschool correspondence schools, you get to use that dollar any way you want, as long as your kids are proficient and they pass the tests.
So the way you wrote this is... the direct educational benefit, and then as provided by law. So your expectation is that a set of rules would follow this direct educational benefit?
Absolutely, certainly. And as I mentioned earlier through the chair, I think to try and settle this matter, I'm in the process of putting together a tax credit bill, let everyone know, in which the tax credit bill would include private and or faith-based educational entities, along with a dozen other entities that are currently getting tax credits. I'm going to run that bill and put it through so we can have that very discussion as to what a, quote, voucher would look like. What I'm trying to accomplish here is to make sure that the stuff, the things that we're doing now, the thousands of Alaskans depend upon now, that millions of dollars are spent on now, are constitutional. There's no question about it. And the reason we're doing these things now is because Alaskans wanted them, and they want them. There wouldn't be any Alaskans doing these things if they didn't want them. It wouldn't be happening. So as we keep expanding in these public-private partnerships, it's inevitable, and it's happened before, three times before in the history of Alaska, that actions taken to help kids and help adults, with the Sheldon Jackson case, were found to be unconstitutional. And some would say, and you heard Nussbaum yesterday, that that was a very narrow interpretation of what our Constitution says. It does not say indirect benefits, it's a direct benefit. No direct benefit. Nothing about indirect, but it was interpreted that way. So you asked me what I would think. Expand an educational system. Parents and families decide the how. The state demands the outcome, the accountability for the public dollars. And I think that's where it's at, as far as I'm concerned, with where this would go. Voucher, tax credit.
Well, it was my intention to try to bring this to a vote today, but I think probably what I'll do so that we can debate it in front of I would like to have a record of debate built in front of the those who record us. So I'm going to bring this back up Wednesday morning or Wednesday during the meeting to debate it and then to vote on it, because I don't know that we do ourselves any greater service by having a longer list of public testimony, because I think both sides have had a fair shot at it. But what we haven't had a fair shot at this point is our own debate. And so I'm sorry, we're right at 3 o'clock. If I rushed a vote at this point, I would not feel, I don't think that would be doing a service to
be the first order of business on Wednesday.
Yeah, I'll bring it up as first order. I'll close public testimony at this point. We'll then debate it. And my apologies, we just ran a committee to the point where I don't know that I could have got that. But I wanted to be fair to the committee to have the chance to put on record their strongest feelings of this particular issue. So with that, I'm going to set it aside until Wednesday. My apologies. We also have the Ombudsman Bill, and we're going to bring up House Bill 24, which is another non-controversial on Stand Your Ground bill. We'll bring that up. And then another one that we need to dispatch, probably House Bill 69, which is the firearms regulation. And that is where we're going to stand up to the federal government if they choose to take the Second Amendment. So as you can see, there's no shortage of highly tense issues to deal with in committee. But I think it would be wise for us to have the debate in committee, go ahead and build a record of debate. Bring your best argument to the table Wednesday. My apologies to the sponsor. I was hoping to get a vote today, but I think it's better to go ahead and have a clean debate on it. So with that, we'll adjourn the committee to Wednesday.